in the traditional fashion. Our way of life is under attack. Those who make themselves our enemy are advancing around the globe. The survival of our friends is in danger. And yet no war has been declared. No borders have been crossed by marching troops. No missiles have been fired. If the press is awaiting a declaration of war, before it imposes the self-discipline of combat conditions, then I can only say that no war ever posed a greater threat to our security. If you are awaiting a finding of clear and present danger, then I can only say that the danger has never been more clear, and its presence has never been more imminent. It requires a change in outlook, a change in tactics, a change in missions by the government, by the people, by every businessman or labor leader, and by every newspaper. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match.
Good evening and welcome to Off Planet Radio Live. It is November the 22nd, 2013. It is 50 years since the day when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. And I wanted to do this without bells and whistles and frills. I played a brief excerpt from Kennedy's speech. This was the speech where he addressed the issues of secret societies. And also at that time, the contest that was going on between the national security state and the press. The backdrop of the JFK assassination is many-fold, and many people have studied it for the last 50 years and seen the battle that was taking place both in the foreground and the background of how media was transitioning even as the country itself was grappling with the security state that had been imposed upon it, and how the security state had, in fact, begun to take over the legitimate government. As you're going to hear in the interviews tonight, there are still to this day many questions that have not been answered. There are many details within the assassination scenario on November 22, 1963 that remain unsolved, largely because of obfuscation and deliberate manipulation of the evidence by the powers behind the scenes who brought about this tragic event. There's very little doubt anymore that this was a single shooter event, or that, in fact, it was not a highly masterminded conspiracy to take out the president who was attempting to honestly grapple with the issues of the day with integrity and a sense of truth. He wasn't a saint. He was simply a man of his time who stood on the edge of history. And he was probably the last legitimately, well, was he even legitimately elected himself? That's a question that Robert Morningstar is going to go into. He was certainly the last president that we would see able to have a free hand during the life of his administration. And he was the last president who would openly oppose what became the cabal that now rules the United States of America. So we're going to continue over the next probably 2.5 hours with interviews. And I have with me on the line tonight a friend, somebody who's been here many times on the show. We've actually done a lot of shows together over the years. And he actually is a figure who stood on the edge of history himself, and I want to welcome Ev Halford. Good evening, Ev.
It's good to be here. I hope that, you know, in this short discussion that we have, I'm able to elucidate a little bit about the Kennedy assassination, at least from, you know, my perspective.
You and I actually met around another radio show years ago, which was called The Grassy Knoll. And so I came to know you kind of with the backdrop of the whole Kennedy assassination and conspiracy theories and all the things that you and I have talked about. You actually were somewhere 50 years ago that sat on the edge of what happened historically the day that followed. You want to talk a little bit about that tonight, Ev?
Well, you know, it's not something I often talk about, but you know, I was 4 years old, actually four, almost 5 years old, in November of 1963. And my father worked for a sensitive civil service job at Kelly Air Force Base, one of the military bases in San Antonio. And somehow he got a special place up in the motorcade. You know, the day before, November the 21st, there was a motorcade in San Antonio in much the same way there would be one in Dallas the next day. And I actually, as crazy as it may sound, got a chance at 4 years old to have a few words with President Kennedy the day before he was shot. The motorcade stopped. My father was holding me up. And Kennedy asked me a few questions. He asked me how old I was, what my name was. And I remember this. It's one of the first memories I have from that period of time of looking at him and Jacqueline Kennedy in the limousine with other officials now who I don't recognize. But, you know, I clearly remember seeing both of them and having this short chat with him the day before he died. It's one of those surreal moments, you know. I've often thought about, you know, of all the children and all the places that he could have spoken that you know, day before, why me? And I guess, you know, as we've talked about, and in fact, I think that one of the first programs I did with Physikov was talking about my father and this kind of Forrest Gump relationship to certain events of history. And I think I was just being carried along with that because he seemed to have been on the fringes of so many of these events of the last 50 years, beginning as far back as I can remember with the Kennedy assassination. And that was a transforming event. It was when the cabal, which rules the world at this point, made their final move and demonstrated that they could kill a president in full view of, you know, witnesses. And even as it was being filmed, and they could get by with it. And to me, it's amazing that they've been getting by with it for so many years, even though, you know, recent polls say that 80% of the Americans believe that there was a conspiracy behind the Kennedy assassination. People still are surprised that the media and the academic community haven't budged an inch on the official story. And this says a lot about, you know, what those in power think about us as human beings, because they're so willing to even at this point lie when they know that most of us, in fact, the vast majority of us don't believe them anymore. But they're so confident to their hold on power that, you know, they'll lie openly. That's just a, you know, small impression of, you know, my own personal experience of that day.
Most people don't have memories going back as young as 4 years old, so I know that made an impression. Do you, to this day, have a visual picture of Mr. Kennedy that day?
Yeah, I remember exactly what he looked like. You know, it's funny, my father, you know, told me that at the time that Kennedy had a lot of makeup on for the cameras. And that it was an eerie thing seeing someone, you know, especially a man, with all of this heavy makeup on. And, you know, my father, in his kind of dark and caustic and cryptic sense of humor, said that he had turned to my mother and mentioned that this is the kind of makeup that, you know, that undertakers will often use, you know, to make someone look a lot better than they in death than they probably looked in life. I don't know if there was something prophetic in that, but it did. You know, I do remember that he looked, you know, kind of pasty in the face, and almost surreal. I mean, it's like, you know, you're watching something, you know, through a kind of foggy, filtered lens, and that's how my memory is of that of those moments.
We have this image of this young, vibrant president, but in fact, Jack Kennedy was not well. In fact, I believe they did not want an autopsy done on him because they were going to discover that he was suffering from, I believe it was an adrenal disease. He was taking injections of adrenaline to keep going. He obviously had serious pain from his wartime back injuries. And so, you know, a lot of what they called Camelot at that time was in fact partially an illusion. President Kennedy in fact was not in the best of health and was apparently in continual pain as well.
You know, I've heard that the Addison's disease, I think, was a
yes.
Was a diagnosis. Look, it's obvious from just studying his life that he was someone that was raised in in kind of elite circles and then decided at some point to turn on the values that he had been raised by Joe Kennedy and the entourage that surrounded his father. And, you know, he was reluctantly pushed into this because, you know, his older brother Joseph was the intended to be the president, and Joseph was killed in a plane crash during the Second World War. And so his father turned to him to fulfill his dreams about having a son that was president. And I think that John Kennedy kind of reluctantly went into that role. And when he realized, you know, what had happened, especially after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, and he realized that who was controlling, you know, the forces of power in the United States, basically the CIA and the intelligence community, and what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, that those people were the ones that were calling the shots. And he openly was talking about dismantling the CIA and dismantling key components of that whole structure. So, you know, there were a lot of people who were upset with him over the way he was taking the country. And, you know...
He had fired the CIA director, Dulles, and he had also formed the Defense Intelligence Agency, I think as a counterfoil to try and decentralize intelligence power, which in that clip that I played going into the show tonight, which was from 1961, he was trying to balance the uber secrecy that was surrounding the government's military operations with freedom of the press, and at the same time not enabling some sort of centralized power to coalesce. So he was really walking a delicate balance throughout the 3 years that he was president.
And he made enemies, as I said, in all areas. He wanted to he wanted to remove the old depletion allowance. He wanted to issue interest-free currency. In fact, he printed up
silver certificates.
Silver certificates, yeah. And he and $2 bills, among other things. And he was obviously not willing to enter into a full deployment in Vietnam, which, you know, Johnson immediately after the assassination reversed all those policies. He was not, you know, at the table with all of those in power, and including, you know, those from both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, that didn't see him as the kind of leader that they wanted. And I think they wanted to make an example about, you know, the absolute power that they felt that they had to control the events going forward. And they basically had a firm hand over the media, over the political arena ever since. And the fact that 50 years on now, you know, there's been no serious questioning of the official story and the official sources in the public media. It has been, you know, they still call those to question, you know, conspiracy theorists with a kind of derisive edge to it. Demonstrates, you know, their confidence that, you know, their absolute control over the minds of, you know, so many in this country.
You yourself have obviously kind of been interwoven over the years in some of the details of this. And part of the reason why I wanted to have you on tonight, Ev, what we've talked about was some of the encounters that you had in your work, as you were a priest in the Russian Orthodox Church, and you encountered what are called the White Russians, and in turn came into some information that plays into this as well. Give us a little bit of the background and details.
Well, actually, I wasn't a priest in the Russian Orthodox Church. I was a priest in the Greek Orthodox
Church.
But I was in the Russian Orthodox Church for a very long time, for like nearly 15 years. In Texas, I was part of what they called the Orthodox Church of America, which was from the Moscow patriarch supporting church. And then after we came to New York, and after an unfortunate experience in a Russian Orthodox seminary, I ended up with the dissident Russian group called the Russian Church Outside of Russia, and I was with them for 7 years, from 1990 to 1997, before I entered into the Greek Church. And then I was ordained to the priesthood in the year 2004. So I was 7 years with them before I was ordained into the priesthood. So I've been a Greek Orthodox priest since 2004, 10 years now. Almost 10 years, yeah, in January.
So in the 1980s, if I recall correctly, you had some encounters with a group called the White Russians. You want to explain that and how that plays into the backstory of the JFK assassination?
Well, anybody, you know, who's read, you know, or done any research on the Kennedy assassination will come across certain key documents. And, you know, long before the internet, I got my hands on a copy of a document called the Torbett document. You know, the official title was what they call a nomenclature of an assassination cabal. It was one of the first documents that I read to question the Kennedy assassination. It was based on the Jim Garrison investigation, allegedly, written by some synonymous attorney named William Torbett. And in that document, it talked about some of the key players in the underground in Dallas, Texas. And among them was a young priest, an American convert named Dimitri Royster, who was named in that document, who I subsequently found out was Marina Oswald's father confessor when she came to Dallas after, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald brought her, back from Russia when he left Russia after defecting, living there for three years. And Royster, who was in his 60s at the time, in the mid-80s and up to 1990, would periodically come down to visit the small Russian church that my wife and I were going to. And he was very fluent in Spanish. In fact, he was a professor of Spanish at SMU, Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and my wife, who is of Mexican-American extraction, used to speak to him in Spanish. And we had a good rapport with him. Of course, at that point, I didn't know how intimately connected he was with the Russian community in Dallas. In fact, at the St. Seraphim Cathedral, over which he presided, was the church in which George de Morenchild and all of these other participants and benefactors, Oswald, attend the church periodically. And in fact, I, it was a good 30 years after the fact, but I was involved with people that were still involved with the de Morenchild family. And it was Royster who had to finally give the final sign-off for me to go to this Russian seminary up in Crestwood, New York, where I attended for a semester. And, of course, that was in 1990, 1 year prior to the so-called collapse of the Soviet Union. And there were actual Soviet students that was attending that seminary when I was there. And it turns out that Royster, if you read the actual testimony of the Warren Commission, that he's mentioned a number of times. I actually went to the assassination records archive and did a word search for him and read. In fact, I printed out the entire transcript of various testimony concerning his involvement with Marina Oswald, during and post the time of the assassination. So now that I know that, that all of these people, including George de Morenchild, had CIA connections, you realize that the so-called white Russian community in Dallas was heavily infiltrated by the intelligence agencies. And it's no surprise then that my father was highly wary of my involvement with these people and tried fervently for the whole several years that we were involved with them in San Antonio to try to get me to distance myself from them. In fact, one time he made a joke about it. He said that if you're not careful, you may find yourself becoming another patsy for these people, and just as Oswald was. And, I think one of, as I said, I've talked about my father and his kind of life on the fringes of all of these things. I mean, he was at NASA during the Mercury program in 1964, just following the assassination, and then in the Vietnam War period, with the escalation, he was involved with DARPA for a while, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And then during the 80s, he was involved, at Lackland Air Force Base with basic training. And he ended his career basically involved with the Defense Mapping Agency, and then with the clinic at Lackland Air Force Base. And one of the last conversations I had before coming to New York was about how the Gulf War, or the first Gulf War, was going to start, because he apparently had advance notice just a couple of weeks beforehand and called me up and said, we're going, to a live war in Kuwait. And he always warned me that his life had been on the fringes of all of these events and that I should be careful. So I was given a kind of glimpse into all of this when I was a very young man.
Do you have an insight today based on everything that you've studied? And I know you've read extensively over the years, Ev, into the JFK assassination, and also, you've done your independent research as well as, your encounters. Do you have any idea to this day who... Somebody asked this in the chat room, and it's a kind of a loaded question because they wanted to know who you believe shot President Kennedy, and yet I don't think we have a single answer for that, do we?
No, I think there were several teams there. There was a redundancy factor that they never wanted there to be a clear answer. I mean, it's layer upon layer upon layer of subterfuge. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me that there were 4 to 5 to 6 different teams there. Each one, you know, finally, you know, thinking that they were the ones that were there to do the job. And, you know, that's part of the problem. You know, it's like the age-old question as to who rules the world. Is it the Jesuits or the Zionists or the Freemasons? You know, and you hear these countless, you know, arguments between various proponents of various sides. And I think that, you know, there's always this kind of multi-layered plan in order to mask the fact of who is in fact behind it. And my gut feeling is that for a brief respite, a brief period of time, these normally warring factions decided to come together because they all saw Kennedy as such a threat to their continued hegemony over whatever aspects of the U.S. economy or U.S. life that they had dominance, that they were all willing to come together in order to see that he was taken out. People that you wouldn't normally think would cooperate. And that's why I think when you look at the Kennedy assassination, you see it pointing in so many different directions. You know, there was mob involvement and CIA involvement and probably possible foreign intelligence agency involvement, and you know, and I think it's
even
very
even just given the fact, even just given the fact that Joseph Kennedy himself, you know, obviously rolled the 1960 election. I mean, he pulled in favors from the gangsters in Chicago. He got the primaries tossed in West Virginia. So, you know, your choice of villains here includes what looks like, in the end, some of the good guys. And Robert Morningstar, who you're going to hear as our third interview tonight, he's going to be after Nick Redfern. Nick Redfern is coming up next. And Morningstar was a pre-record we did last week. He did almost 3 hours, of which we're going to air an hour tonight. And we'll post a bit. Robert Morningstar goes extensively into a whole list of people as well. And when you begin to look at the theater that was mapped out that day in Dallas, it looks like a shooting gallery, and it looks like there were multiple shooters with multiple agendas, multiple weapons involved. And it seems like they just lined up every possible angle and corralled President Kennedy and his motorcade into a shooting gallery.
Yeah, and I think that there were gunmen, as I said, from every different group that had a hatred for Kennedy and Kennedy's plans.
Yeah, and don't forget the Cubans. There's Robert Morningstar talks about this as well. The Cuban who is a man.
Yeah, the anti-Castro Cubans,
yeah.
Who were very upset because of his failure to provide the air cover for the Bay of Pigs invasion. And you know, I tend to be sympathetic that the actual people on the ground were the people that Mark Lane in his book Plausible Denial claims, that there, you know, that it was David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans, you know, that were major players in this whole thing.
Well, and David Ferry has, you know, there's some interesting details about Ferry as well. I mean, he seems to go through this it almost like one of the fibers in a tapestry, and connecting him Once you connect him to Jack Ruby, you connect him back to the CIA operations he was running because he had been fired from Eastern Airlines over a homosexual liaison. It becomes more and more interesting to see that there were central figures in this, chief of which was probably Jack Ruby himself.
And the fact that, you know, all of the illegal gun running that was part of the whole Louisiana connection to this, he was involved in that as well. I mean, there were so many different aspects of, you know, coming together to deal with a common enemy that I'm not surprised, you know, by any of the people, you know, that have been linked to this or, you know, fingers have been pointed towards them. My problem is that people want to have simple answers. They want to have a, you know, plot like a Hollywood movie, and I think that there were far more people involved than a simple plot in, you know, a monolinear plot in a Hollywood movie.
Oh, it's multidimensional. In a lot of ways, there's so many creepy aspects to it. You riff on the numbers alone. I got to thinking about this. You have 11 cars in the motorcade traveling at 11 miles an hour, and it is November 22nd, which the digits add up to 33, in Dallas, sitting on the 33rd parallel.
The parallel, I know. It's amazing if you think about it. But when you think about the fact that in Freemasonry, these numbers have intense significance, and there's Freemasonry around every aspect of this. And in fact, Dealey Plaza itself was the site of one of the first Freemason temples in Texas. And if you go and you look at the site, even today, you know, we managed to see the site back in 1990, 20 years ago. I took a Greyhound bus trip from New York to San Antonio. It was a horrible trip, but the bus stopped in Dallas, and it turns out that the Greyhound bus station was a couple of blocks away from Dealey Plaza. And I took my wife, and we had two children. You know, they were, my son, I think, was almost five, and we had an infant, and we walked around Dealey Plaza and looked at at all of the landmarks there. And I looked up at the sixth floor of the school book depository. I had just seen the JFK movie a short time before, so, you know, I was fully aware. And I had read, you know, all of these Kennedy assassination books at that point, Mark Lane's Plausible Denial and Rush to Judgment and Henry Holt's Reasonable Doubt and On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison and a whole litany of these books, and actually see that, actually see how much smaller it is than we imagined. And just, you know, and that's one of the hard things to fathom is, you know, all those gunmen and all of those participants involved in this conspiracy basically standing around everywhere, which is no surprise to me, you know, with all the videos that, you know, I've seen, including the Robert Groden's compilation of all of the, you know, extant videos that he had, you know, that he had found, showing everyone running towards the grassy knoll immediately after the shots were fired. And then when you realize that the so-called grassy knoll was in fact a fence line that led to a parking lot and a railway yard.
Yes.
And there was a tower there that Lee Bowers was sitting in, one of the first witnesses to have been killed under strange circumstances, because he claimed that he saw some men with rifles standing at the fence. And all the witnesses that have been killed, I mean, this is one of the aspects of the of all of these false flag operations, is those that are that have information that could potentially open up the truth about the false flag, you know, those witnesses are very quickly eliminated.
Well, and now, you know, they've refined it to such a point. Somebody in the chat room mentioned about Sandy Hook. Well, now you have completely prefabricated events with actors, crisis actors, and this stuff is just played out as media events. This particular event in Dallas was actually the perfect storm in so many ways, because it not only launched a whole change in the government. I mean, we saw at least three American presidents involved, if you consider the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush was also seen on the ground in Dallas that day. You have Gerald Ford, who would wind up on the Warren Commission, and you have Lyndon Baines Johnson. But you also had the media profile.
Oh, Richard Nixon as well, by the way.
Richard Nixon as well, yeah. Yeah, he doesn't remember where he was that day, though.
No.
But you have the next generation of politicians.
It was a great film, though, that I saw by John Hankey. I don't know if you're familiar with it, about the JFK assassination. It's one of the best films that I've seen.
I've not seen that, no.
So my recommendation is that to do a Google search of the name John Hankey, H-A-N-K-E-Y, and you'll come across his film that he did, and it basically goes over the anti-Castro Cuban connection, and I thought it was fascinating. And you know, and if you've read anything about, you know, Mark Lane's work,
yes,
then you'll be familiar with the story he tells in this film. And of course, he shows the Skull and Bones connection to all of it, and how all of these Sal and Dulles and a lot of the key players involved, you know, were from Yale and had been part of the Skull and Bones Society.
Now, that's a connection that is beyond interesting, the whole Skull and Bones connection. That's one that I had not really thought about.
And, you know, there was a movie that I think Matt Damon made called, trying to remember the name, where he it was a kind of pseudo retelling of the life of James Jesus Angleton. And he talked a lot about the secret rituals of the Skull and Bones and the whole underpinning in this society of these secret organizations. And you know, I've had a tremendous fascination with the with these kind of secret societies that, you know, which is interesting because it goes back to what John Kennedy said in the speech about how Americans have never really been open to the idea of secret societies running everything. But that's precisely what we have now, is, you know, these people with the secret handshakes, you know, and the secret rituals, often occult rituals. And they're the ones that are basically still running the show now. And since the coup of 1963, where they took out a president, they make no qualms about the fact that, you know, that they rule this country with an iron hand. I mean, my son was commenting about the police state nature, you know, how much more open now they are, where they used to mask the fact or would make a pretense about, you know, freedom and, you know, would train people, you know, to believe that, you know, we were basically an egalitarian democracy here. But now, you know, they don't make any pretense about who's in charge and that we're basically inmates in a prison system. You know, we're wage slaves for most of them. And I don't think that would have been possible without the first being able to take out a president and then basically subvert the media and prevent the truth about that event from ever coming out. They're pretty confident now that they can stage false flag operations and to keep everyone in line. And I think that's, if anything, that's one of the greatest legacies of the social control that they gained by successfully taking out a president.
Yeah, the Kennedy assassination was very much about securing the elite's place in the forming world. If you stop to think about it, JFK was really the first post-war, World War II president. We had, obviously, Truman, who hung over from the war period, and then Eisenhower, who was basically elected on the strength of, you know, his military prowess during the war. So Kennedy represented kind of a shift and a real possible changeover, because we had this security state that was brought in, and this is one of the linchpins to all of this, was they never explained to us exactly what the National Security Act was. Most people have never read it, and most people don't really understand that not only was there a National Security Act and a National Security Agency, but in fact, in order to implement post-war security, they actually jettisoned the original constitutional government and stepped up what Eisenhower then called the military-industrial complex, which was basically the cabal of the corporate business interests and military and the military and intelligence agencies themselves.
And that's who's ruling this country now. That's who calls the shots on, you know, and the kind of government, the kind of safety net that we have. They're the ones that fund the elections for congressmen, and they're the ones that determine what policies are implemented by, you know, our so-called representatives in Congress, and they're the ones that influence the judges in the courts. I mean, there hasn't been a legitimate, serious investigation of anything in the last 50 years. Everything has been a cover-up.
Well, it's basically allowing the criminals to investigate themselves. When you look at the Warren Commission and how that was stacked out, I mean, these were bought men.
Yeah, but, you know, there shouldn't be commissions. I mean, I want to, you know, why did, you know, these commissions are always there to rubber stamp an official story. I mean, we have a court system, and, you know, a court system requires an adversarial position, requires discovery, the subpoena of witnesses, the compulsion of testimony.
Well, this is what
that's
you.
That's how you get the
but
truth.
This is how you operate in the absence of evidence, because the evidence would be completely damning to the establishment's position. So you jettison the witnesses, you jettison the perps, you get rid of, or you alter the evidence, just as, I mean, right down to even the Kennedy autopsy. And then you have a rubber stamp commission who takes what remains of so-called evidence and puts together the most ludicrous stories in the world. I mean, the single bullet theory that Arlen Specter propounded, that bought Arlen Specter 40 years of power in government, just as it bought Gerald Ford the presidency and all the other people in that commission who did not stand up.
And the one attempt, the House Assassination Committee during the 70s, that, you know, after the replacement of the CIA director, you know, that was shut down. They will not allow a serious investigation or discovery or witnesses or the gathering of evidence for anything. And, you know, just in my own personal experience, in my own little copyright case, they won't even allow discovery. They've not allowed any discovery at all or any suit to go to a discovery stage for 9/11.
Well, you do remember that post-Kennedy, 1964, they completely recontoured the entire justice system. Beginning with the federal courts and moving it right down to the local level. They basically reconfigured the courts to be, I guess you would call them courts of equity under UCC. Court system changed as well.
No, everything changed. And, you know, the consolidation of the media, the allowing mass conglomerates, you know, to own everything, you know, buying up all of the family-owned publishing houses and creating these huge three-company conglomerate that owned all the publishing and didn't control what books are published or what movies are made. I mean, there were always monopolies in Hollywood. But now it's all part of the same military-industrial complex and intelligence complex. I mean, you know, I remember early on when the Internet was created and back in the mid-90s, and I used to go to the public library because we didn't have a computer. And I would read about, you know, things like Operation Mockingbird, about this, you know, the CIA involvement in the publishing industry and in the media, about the fact that, you know, the Reese Commission, the tax exempt foundations during the 1950s that received all the funding, and how they basically controlled academia in this country. And the creation of the Department of Education, you know these kind of pet peeves of, you know, of those on the right, the so-called conservatives. You know, I think, you know, I've never believed in, you know, this false left-right paradigm. You know, it's one of the things my father told me many, many times growing up, that they're all working for the same team. It's theater. It's like, you know, Punch and Judy, you know.
Well, it's dichotomy. I mean, and if you look at it from the strictest sense, John Kennedy probably was, in the old sense, the last true conservative president we had. He was a fiscal conservative. He was conservative in the sense, and this was the speech that I played from 1961 at the beginning. He was straddling the lines between control and freedom, understanding that the world we lived in did require a certain amount of security, but it didn't require a security state, and he still believed in the freedom of the press at that time. And, you know,
well, he said in that speech that it was the press, a free press, that was the protector of these things, and we haven't had a free press in such a long time. I mean, I don't want to harp on my own personal, you know, experiences concerning, you know, my own involvement with the courts, but we do not have a free press in any sense of the word in this country. If you have a contrary opinion to the official line, you're not going to be allowed for your voice to be in any kind of public forum. It's just the way it is. I mean, you know, there's a large alternative media in the Internet and other places, but
well, it's
the mainstream is, you know, you're not going to be invited.
Unfortunately, the alternative media is fractured and fragmented so badly by individual interests and egos and control structures. The Internet free press will be gone in 5 years, I think. Whatever
Google
there is.
Google basically corralled any real effective free speech. So we were talking about the fact that the way that these search engines work now, it used to be that, you know...
Oh, I know. They gamed it completely. Would, yeah. We used to be getting 2,000 to 5,000 hits a week on our website, and after Google reconfigured their search engines last year, we saw the numbers drop to like 10%.
Well, you know, just an interesting thing, and this is a sidebar, is that I was looking up to see some of the old interviews that we had done, and I typed my name, Ev... the program's Ev Halford, and what came up on a Google search was, bore absolutely no resemblance to anything that, you know, and you couldn't find the programs. You'd have to go 5, 6, 7, 8 pages deep before you would even come across one of the programs.
We got deep sixed, basically, and that's what's happening.
And the phone software, which I don't think can be an accident, that the phone software, you know, unless you're paying attention, will you know, corrects my name with Wilford or something that, you know, that bears no real resemblance to the name. I think at some level they don't want us to find the information, And that's what Google's purpose ultimately was for. It wasn't to be a search engine. It was to be a methodology to prevent certain information from being readily available on the Internet.
Yeah. So, you know, here we are 50 years later, and we're fighting the same battles all over again, and we're watching the same forces suck the life out of anybody that dares to stand up and challenge the status quo. Ev, we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we have Nick Redfern in the queue. Let people know a little bit about your book, the Omega Conspiracy, which they can find on Amazon.
Yeah, I have two books. You know, the first was Vision. It was called Visionary. It was published in 2008. In fact, I think one of the second interview that I did with you back in January of 2009 was about that book. First was actually about Russia. You know, that's how you and I came to be. Is that you heard an interview that I did with Visigoth on the Grassy Knoll program about Russia, and you asked me to come on your program. And the threshing floor.
Yes.
I wrote a book back in 2001, just before 9/11, called The Omega Conspiracy. And after 9/11 happened, I kind of sat on that book because it was basically a novelization and almost a satire, but, you know, told kind of tongue-in-cheek, but very real, about how the NSA worked, how the FBI and the CIA worked, and how false flags work. And how stage terror basically works to manipulate people in order to believe certain things about the world. And that was the book that I wrote. And, you know, now things have come full circle, and I finally decided that I was going to actually release that book, and it's been put up on Kindle now for Amazon, and, you know, depending if I can get sales on that, then I'm going to finance, you know, putting out a print copy. I don't think I'm going to find one of the mainstream publishers that are willing to publish a book that actually deals with the way the NSA works and the surveillance grid. I mean, there's a whole story in the book about a anti-terror organization called Omega, created by this my magic boy hero from the screenplay that I wrote back about the same time, and how he's creating an army to fight these secret societies. And he's building his own highly technical army to deal with them. And they decide that they're going to masquerade at least a part of their group as a video club and deliver their messages in descriptions for movies. So this FBI guy, who's one of the major characters, gets a hold of this disc, and he calls in one of the top cryptologists from the FBI to decipher this disc, and he's not able to do it. There's a hacker in the book called Agamemnon who is able to finally crack the disc open, and in it are a treasure tour of 208 documents describing how this particular secret society plans to extend its hegemony to rule the world. This was a way of commentary at the time about what I saw is how this group that currently controls the world actually operates. And in that book, I made numerous references to the JFK assassination. You know, hints for those who've read that are familiar with the JFK conspiracy, that they can understand, you know, how all of this, you know, even though it's couched as a story, is very much a commentary as to how the world really works. And it's told in a kind of, you know, my son was joking earlier that the major impetus of this is about a strawberry festival in a small town in Virginia. kind of tongue in cheek in a way, but how they try to create for us and for, you know, a kind of matrix like world of comfort and, you know, and Twitter while they're doing their nefarious deeds, you know, in the dark. And now they're becoming even bolder and they're actually stepping into the light and doing their nefarious deeds now out in front of everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Ev, it's been great talking to you. We're gonna jump out here, and now we have Nick Redfern queued up. The book, again, is called The Omega Conspiracy. It's on Amazon. I put a link in the chat room. We'll put a link up with the show. And we want to thank our first hour guest for tonight, Ev Halford, also known as Michael Halford. And thanks for coming on.
Good to be here. Thank you.